from Local 12 Sports. It's the Skinny Podcast. Now, here's Richard Skinner.
Welcome into the Skinny Podcast. It's the weekly potpourri edition. I'm Richard Skinner, Local12.com digital sports columnist and editor with Rick Roaring. Each and every week, we talk about sports topics of local interest. Occasionally, there's a national topic to throw in. In football season, we've got a betting segment. But this time of year, we don't. Thank God I didn't bet on the NCAA tournament. My picks in a pick game were just disastrous. And, of course, my favorite part of the podcast where you can ask me a question on any topic, just hit up the X first, hashtag Ask Skinny Anything. Rick, we're recording this on a Wednesday where the Reds are about to finish their first technically full week of baseball, get a day off on Thursday. So we got some Reds to get to, certainly some college basketball to get to, and much, much more.
Yeah, we'll start with the Reds. They are 3-2 overall since opening day last week. They're coming off a 9-4 loss on Tuesday night that has generated some buzz, Skinny. In that game, Ellie De La Cruz committed a pair of errors that proved costly. He has three errors through the first five games. He actually was credited with a third error in that game that was later changed, I believe. He also overslid the base on Saturday that cost the Reds an out. So far, he's 5-for-20 at the plate with one walk and 10 strikeouts. It seems to me a lot of fans are starting to sort of cross the line here on how they feel about Ellie, from exciting superstar to kind of overhyped disappointment. And I think we can get into how out over the skis and how emotional some people are after the reaction to his couple of errors last night. But where are you at on Ellie? Are you worried about him? And does his play annoy you from what we saw in Tuesday night's game?
Annoy me? No. But yeah, I do start to worry, because there's plenty of guys who have shown unicorn-like ability that just they never pan out. They're never a ball player, if you will. And I'm not here to tell you that I'm passing that judgment on Ellie De La Cruz yet. Nobody should, in my opinion. Because there is some just ridiculous raw talent there. But until he fixes his approach at the plate, until the fact that maybe he comes to grips and they come to grips with that he's just not a natural shortstop, it's just not his position, we're going to go through these things. You know, oversliding the base, it bugs me, because a lot of guys who go in head first now, it feels like they all overslide the base. I don't know what happened to the good old-fashioned, you know, foot-first pop-up slide, but that's a thing of the past, and these guys going in head first. And you can see a lot of fielders now on steals are just putting the glove there and literally waiting for you to tag yourself out when you go past the base. It's not just him. It's other guys that do it too. So, I think in a perfect world, your shortstop in the future is going to be Edwin Arroyo, which means at some point you're going to have to come to the conclusion of Ellie De La Cruz playing someplace else, be that third base. Probably not, because that's Noelvi Marte, and then possibly the outfield. You know, again, he's 6'5". Maybe he's a first baseman when all is said and done, and that's okay too. But the approach at the plate is starting to get bothersome, if you will.
It seems like his arm would be a waste at first base.
I agree with that, Rick. I'm with you.
The arm is such a cannon. I mean, I think you put him in the outfield if you are going. Now, third base would be ideal, but again, if you've got Marte, that's going to be a tough sell as well.
Yeah, I thought he was more natural at third base because it's more reactionary as opposed to him having to go side saddle ground balls, et cetera, and then just try to show off his arm to do so. I just felt like he was, for whatever reason, again, it's such a reactionary position, and he's got great reactions.
That's the thing. I think third base is the position he's built to play because he covers a lot of ground there. Like you said, he's got those quick cat-like reactions, and he's long and athletic. He can sort of make that quick diving stab, and then he's got a cannon. So he is a good third baseman, I think. But the problem is, Skinny, we're not talking about his ability at shortstop right now. He's getting to plenty of balls. He's making plays. The problem is the nonchalant list, yes. The flashiness, quote unquote, if you will, that is annoying people. And I go back and forth on it. Cause like on one hand, I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Eliminate this stuff. There's no need for the flipping it with your glove on that ball to second base where he almost floated out into center field. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah. What was the point of that?
And then the nonchalant thrower to first base where he pulls Encarnacion Strand off the bag. And granted, Encarnacion Strand probably should make that catch. A good first baseman stretches out, uses his length, and makes that catch instead of falling down. But
it was wet. You know, the pitchers had made a point it was hard to grip the ball. So there's a little bit of that from the Tuesday night game too, a little bit.
I think the issue people have, though, Skinny, is not so much any of these things individually. At least for me, that's how I look at it. It's not any of these plays are egregious, but it's kind of the manner in which they're happening. Like you said, okay, yeah, the ball is wet, but that wasn't a bang-bang play where he's charging in real fast and making a quick throw. Right. It's a nonchalant play where he's kind of half-assing it, and then he makes a bad throw. And that's where people get frustrated. And the same thing with sliding over the base on Saturday. It's not a big issue. You see it happen all the time. He's being aggressive. He's super fast. That probably is a hard play to stop your momentum there. But it just feels like right now, and even going back to last year, he's good for a mistake a night or every other night at least. And it's like, when is he going to get rid of those mistakes? Because all the other stuff I can live with, it's tantalizing to think about what he can be, even if he's only hitting 240. You know, I think he's at 250 right now, but we talked about it last week. You don't need him to hit 300 to be really high on what he brings to this team and talk about his game-changing potential, but you can't live with him making costly mistakes every night or every other night.
Yeah, he was supposed to be the centerpiece of the rebuild, right? Since I've seen McClain play, I think he is, but obviously he isn't at the moment because he's not available because of health. And you know, obviously Marte was another big piece, and he's not available now. So, you know, it's kind of down to CES and him. I guess Spencer Steer to a degree, but because Spencer technically was a rookie last year. But this was supposed to be the guy that was the next coming. And again, I don't need that to be within a year, 2 years, whatever that is. I mean, time frames are different for guys to develop and all those things, but there doesn't seem to be much progress. And I think that's the disappointing part at the moment.
Yeah. And again, I think it's not even necessarily the progress in terms of more production. It's the progress of getting rid of some of the silliness and the things that you don't expect out of a professional.
You know, I say this a lot as a basketball coach, because guys love to make the Sports Center pass. And I told kids a bunch of times on the track, I said, listen, none of this stuff's going on Sports Center tonight. Just do me a favor, make an easy play. When there's an easy pass to be made, make an easy pass. I don't need a 45-foot bounce pass it's going to look great when it works, but more times than not, it's not going to work. So for this guy too, make a routine play a routine play, okay? It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be throwing across your body. It doesn't have to be flipping with your glove. Make a routine play the routine way.
Yeah. Now, and I do think it's worth remembering, like, Brandon Phillips took a lot of flack for stuff like this. He didn't run out some fly balls, and there is a time or two where he may have gotten a little too fancy, was trying to flip the ball with his glove, but he was also a gold glover, and he made so many damn good plays that, like, I mean, there is a little bit of a give and take with talented players like that who do these types of things and can be flashy, that you want to give them a little rope to make the spectacular play. Or like in Ellie's case, even not talking about the defense, but on the base pass, he does so many incredible things and can sort of wreck your defense with his chaos and the pressure he puts on you on the base paths. But he also might run into a silly out occasionally doing that stuff. I think there is a little bit of give and take with all of this stuff when you're dealing with a player of his potential.
Yeah, I think the difference with Brandon Phillips is nobody really even knew who he was when the Reds traded for him. And then he all of a sudden, voila, he pops up and is a really good player for a long period of time. A lot is expected of Ellie De La Cruz, and it should be. A lot was expected of Mike Trout. Didn't take him long to produce, did it? A lot was expected of Bryce Harper. Didn't take him long to produce either, did it? Again, we're six games into his second season. He technically has not even played a full major league season yet. But again, I got to start seeing some signs of progress, please.
All right, let's talk about some of the other storylines from the first week of the season here for the Reds. And Skinny, I think one of the things that jumps out to me is I've been watching every game, and each game I kind of feel like this isn't going real well. I don't love the way this team is playing, but lo and behold, they've come out with a winning record. They've found a way to win a couple of games that maybe they shouldn't have. So I think you feel pretty positively about that start from that perspective. I think the biggest storyline so far has been Nick Martini's big opening day and his strong start. I mean, it's just fun to see a guy like that who grinds for so long, and it's not clear if he even has a path going forward, and he decides to stick it out. He's bouncing. Like, I can't imagine being a minor leaguer on the bus last year, Louisville, talking to Jim Kelch and going back out there and thinking, man, I'm 10 years older than a lot of these guys out here and still sticking with it. It's so cool to see him get that opportunity this year and succeed.
Yeah, the couple ones for me, one of the positives is I think you're seeing the depth of this lineup too. And that's without what we've talked about, the heart and soul in TJ Friedl and Matt McClain. You saw the great at bat from Jonathan India grinding out a walk, and he's done a nice job in the leadoff spot. You see the continued, I think, ascension of Will Benson, hits the homer to tie it. Christian Encarnacion Strand got off to a slow start, then he whacks the homer and he's started to hit a little bit. Jamer Candelario's hit a little bit. You saw the bottom of the order on opening day, Spencer Steer, Nick Martini, and Tyler Stevenson. Those guys hit 7, 8, 9 in the lineup, and they accounted for all 8 RBI. You see Spencer Steer hit the grand slam. I think that's the positive. They all haven't hit the way I expect them to hit consistently, but you see the depth of this lineup for me. And then the negative, I think, honestly, the bullpen's just been an utter disappointment.
Yeah, the bullpen has been a concern. What did you think of Hunter Green? Because we got his first start, and I felt like it was pretty similar to what we've come to expect from Hunter Green. Two earned runs, five hits, which is fine. Seven Ks, which is great. But then four walks, and he only pitches 4 2/3.
Right. I mean, at what point does he trust his other stuff? Because it doesn't feel like he's still there yet. And when does he get that trust? Because if not, he's still just going to be a two-pitch pitcher. And if that's the case, I hate to do it because, again, this is way too early in his career. He's the closer of the future.
Yeah, but Skinny, the thing is, I think he might be even good enough with just two pitches if he just throws strikes.
Yeah, if he throws strikes, that's the thing. And listen, again, one start, we may look back on this start in 2 months and go, hey, you know, he just got off it wasn't a horrible start. It was an okay start, but boy, look at him now. Yeah. I hope we're at that point, but it feels like it's Groundhog Day of it'll be one of these and then two really goods and then another one of these and then maybe a good and then another one of these and then two really goods. The one thing I can say is I'm starting to feel like, and I just said it when we did the breakout stuff last week, the Graham Ashcraft train's rolling forward, man, and I think that's a positive.
Yeah, Graham Ashcraft looked really good again in his first start. And that's the thing. It's only one start. We fully are aware of that. But with Hunter Green,
you start seeing progress.
Yeah, with Hunter Green, it's just like you said, it's Groundhog Day. It's like every start we watched last year where it's like, okay, I see the stuff. The seven strikeouts is incredible. But like 4 2/3 innings, man, quit walking four guys in those first four innings and you'll pitch deeper into games. Hopefully he'll be able to figure that out. One question I had for you, going back to the first thing I brought up with Nick Martini. I know, I get it. Arguing about lineups is dumb. I don't enjoy this, but just from a sports guy perspective, Skinny, when you see a guy have a day like Nick Martini did on opening day, do you not as a coach start that guy the next game? I have a major issue with sitting that guy out the next game because lo and behold, he came up with a big hit in that game too when you pinch hit him late. It's like, yeah, when a guy's hot, he's hot. Play him.
But it was Patrick Corbin. I think it was lefty-lefty, and I think he just looked
at him. I do not care. You had two home runs the game before.
Off the top of my head, I don't know what his career splits are. There isn't a large sample size for his career splits, but I'm going to guess the analytics would have suggested he sits against the lefty.
That's where the analytics drive me crazy. Agree with them for the most part, Skinny, but when a guy hits back-to-back home runs the day before, it was a day in between, but the game before, you let him be hot. Let a hot guy cook.
Well, but
have then a little feel.
I'll go this. I mean, he was able to come off the bench as a left-handed pinch hitter and hit the big two-run double that day. So I think it worked out well for both. It let him play to his strength, and David Bell had a really nice left-handed bat to utilize in that game.
Well, I did like him coming off the bench, but again, Skinny, if he hit the home run there, maybe he would have done it a few innings sooner. When a guy is hot, you play him. That is just my feeling on the whole platoon thing. I get the analytics. All things equal, play the numbers. But also have a little feel. When a guy's smoking hot and he's got this momentum of opening day, he's this guy's been bouncing around. It's a big moment in his career. Let that guy cook. See if you can have the Jeremy Lin moment and let him run for half a season.
Yeah, I just don't think that. I think the right thing to do is he plays against righties, period, end of story.
I guess my point was, like, we've seen the Dietrichs of the world come through here. We know this might not last long for Nick Martini.
Not gonna.
Why not get the most out of him while you can? He is hot right now. That is my point. Well, I'm not saying he's going to be a star going forward.
But I think you played to his strength the next day, which was coming off the bench against a right-hander and providing a big pinch hit for them. And I think if that plays to his strength and he has all the confidence in the world hitting against righties and doesn't lose confidence when he faces lefties because he can't hit them, I'm all for that then.
Fair enough. Any other topics from the Reds' first week here that you want to discuss?
No, and as we're recording this, they're actually playing the rubber game against Philly. And to your point, it doesn't feel like a clean start. But you win today, as again, we're doing this in the morning before the game. That's two series wins in a row, and one of them against a World Series contender. Again, it's not been clean. It's not been aesthetically great. But 4-2 and two series wins is a pretty good way to start this thing. And we were all worried about, good God, were they going to get off to a 2-8 start? And it sure felt like it was heading in that direction late on Sunday, did it not?
And that's exactly, I couldn't have felt that way more, Skitty. We had just talked about it. I go, oh no, is this really going to be that way? And McClain being out really factors into my emotions right now so much because I was so high on him coming into the year that admittedly it's made me more pessimistic about how all this is going. And I'm probably too on the negative side right now when these games get off to a rocky start. But yeah, I mean, to your point, if they start 4-2 here, even 3-2, I'm very happy with now.
Yeah.
If they start 4-2 here, and again, we don't know if they'll get McClain back at all this year, and he probably won't be a factor if they do. But if you get Lodolo back here in a week and you get a couple of these other guys rolling, if Friedel comes back and he's able to help you out, I mean, if they hold serve now, I think you can feel really good about this thing in a month.
And I would say this too, the Nick Martini start, and again, it could just have been those two games and he goes over his next 20, even against right-handers. I don't know that. The one thing it does, it buys you time for TJ Friedl to come back. When he comes back, then it gives you that rotation of Fraley can DH as a lefty, you know, maybe one day Will Benson DHs as the lefty. It just gives you so much more flexibility. But if Martini can at least continue to hold his own, he's going to buy you time and give you a nice bridge to the Friedl situation coming back.
All right, let's switch gears to college basketball, Skinny. The Final Four is on Saturday night. NC State and Purdue will tip it off at 6:09 p.m., and Alabama will take on UConn at 8:49. Both of those games can be seen on TBS and TNT. They're being simulcast on both stations. Skinny, what's your favorite part about these Final Four matchups that we're left with?
The fact that we're back to playing through centers in the post. It's different. I mean, remember that had gone away, right? It was the
big time.
And here we are with they play through Burns, North Carolina State does, and he's fun to watch. He's great. It's cartoon characterish to some degree, but he's really skilled for as big as he is. He really is. He's got a nice little baby hook to him. He's strong. He enjoys the game. You can tell how much fun he's having and understand because they've been playing with house money since they made the damn tournament, for goodness sakes. And obviously, Edie's just – people hate Edie, and I guess it's just because everybody hates the biggest guy on the floor because, oh, look how you're not very – you're just big. Dude, he's really good in there, and he gets the living – daylights beat. I thought Tennessee beat the crap out of him. There could have been at least another dozen fouls called on him being guarded in the post. And he's just got such a nice touch. And I know he should. He's 7'4". Well, I've seen 7'4" before that can't play a lick. And then obviously, the stupidity of Illinois of, hey, let's try to go at the 7-footer one more time. Hey, you know what? It didn't work the whole first. Let's do it again.
What was Brad Underwood's quote during that little halftime interview? If he blocks us 100 times, he blocks us 100 times. Okay. He did.
Yeah, he sure did. And Alabama is just fun because they're just crazy offensively. So, Rick, we talked analytics, right? You're a big KenPom guy. And I know it's fluid since the tournament started. Numbers change a little bit. But remember before the tournament, I think we identified five teams that if you go back to 2002 fit KenPom analytics to win this whole thing. And they work hard. I mean, but it's funny to see that literally two of them are still standing. You had to be top 22 in defense, and you had to be top 9 in offense. And UConn and Purdue are that. And it's funny, the top 3 offensive teams in KenPom are left in UConn, Purdue, and Alabama. The complete outlier here is NC State's metrics show they should have been out way longer ago. They are literally defying every metric known to mankind. I think they're, 40th in both offense and defense, or close to that.
Yeah, but Skinny, I think we have to account for this now every year when we do our brackets. We have to do the thing we said about KenPom of like, hey, here are the teams that actually have a chance to win, and we do the numbers that you ran through. You got to be this in offense. You got to be this in defense. And quite frankly, look what we're seeing this year. I mean, if you're the best offensive teams in the country, you have the best chance to win. I've been saying that forever. Look, UConn, Purdue, Alabama, 1, 2, 3 in the country in offensive efficiency. And then we also have to have the caveat of every year there is going to be a team of chaos that you have to respect, and you should hold them in the highest regard after you see them getting going, because once the chaos starts, it's going to keep happening. I mean, every year now we have a team in the Final Four that is ranked lower than a 7 seed.
Well, remember your prop bet that you liked before the tournament started, the seed number combined?
Yes, over 12.5.
12.5, right? Yeah. So we have 2-1 seeds, which that would make you go. If I told you 2-1 seeds are going to make it, you'd gulp and go, I don't think I'm going to win my bet. You got a 4 seed, not a complete out, but then you got the outlier. The 11 pushes it over the total.
Yep, and that's exactly why we said it was a good bet, because it's like, even if you end up with 3-1 seeds, you still would have had the chance if you got the 11 seed in there.
That's right.
You know, I mean, so every year it feels like we get one of these NC State type teams to make their run, and it's been fun to watch. I don't think they have a chance to win at all, but they've been fun to get there.
They have been fun to watch because it feels like I didn't watch them much in the regular season. I did watch them some in the ACC tournament. I stayed up that night that the dude makes the impossible 3 to force overtime against Virginia. And I think it was the semifinal round, and they go on to beat Virginia and then go on to win the tournament. But watching them pretty intently in this tournament, because you get locked into games, right? I don't know if their identity was always playing through Burns and locking down on defense, but they're really good defensively, and playing through him against really anybody. Filipowski's long, and he just bullied him in that game. Now, I know he's younger, he's thinner, and all those, but he's long, and Burns just bullied him in that Duke game.
I'm sure Kevin Keats is thinking, he's the head coach of NC State, I'm sure he's thinking, why couldn't my guys defended like this all year?
Right.
Why
right.
couldn't I gotten this type of commitment and this type of energy and this type of toughness from my guys on the defensive end consistently throughout the regular season? Because if we had, we would have been a completely different team all year. But you're right. Defensively, they've been on it throughout the tournament.
Yeah, I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this. I wonder what even going into the ACC tournament, what their KenPom metric was defensively.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's no way to look. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can go back and look it up. I won't do that while we're here. But yeah, I mean, it was probably it's probably improved dramatically since the start of the tournament. I just think there. I mean, a couple things that I still find fun about this tournament. Purdue's redemption story. I know people don't like Purdue. I know they don't like watching Zach Edey play, but I just think it's interesting.
Why do you think that is? Because I actually
it's a terrible style of basketball. I mean, it's like watching James Harden. It's throw the ball to one guy, let him do this thing, and then get a foul. And that is hard to watch at times. But it's also, to your point, I don't understand the thing like Zach Edey isn't good. We've seen so many 7 foot plus guys that have no ability, no coordination, no skill, and they flame out or they don't become anything. To see a guy who is such a high basketball IQ, so coordinated, have the body control that he has at that size, it's incredible. I mean, I have to imagine this is kind of similar to what it was like watching Shaq at LSU back in the day in terms of the dominance. Like, I was too young to really understand that, but like,
it's funny, Shaq just dominated with brute strength and really didn't have a great jump hook game at that point. Edey does. I mean, Edey's got just a beautiful touch, and he's just, the thing I like and admire is because it's hard to teach, especially at my level, teaching young bigs. And trust me, I've very rarely coached bigs at the schools I've been at. I've had a couple of them being patient, putting the ball on the floor when they catch it in the post and kind of letting things clear out, letting things settle. Because as soon as you put it down, you've made a commitment of some kind. He does a really good job of just kind of hanging for a second, looking to see where's my pass coming from, where might the double come from, where am I going to go? And if the double doesn't come fast enough, then he puts it down, rises up, and shoots that jump hook. I think he's beautiful to watch in the post. I do.
And that's where I'm talking about his IQ is just so much different from most of the other guys we've seen. He really understands the game, like you said. I mean, when he catches the ball, he'll survey. He'll understand where guys are cutting, wait for it to clear out for him, give him more space, all those types of things. I mean, he's really reading what's going on around him.
Rick, he did it on – and granted, they played everything through him, and rightfully so, because he literally carried the load for them on Sunday against Tennessee. But there were a couple times where he threw it back out, and I literally yelled at the TV, go repost. I didn't need to be yelling at him because he knew what to do. He was immediately throwing it out so he could repost, because a couple times Tennessee did a good job to walk him off his spot, and he realized where he caught it. It wasn't a place to make a move, so back out it went. Deeper in he went. I'm like, that's a guy who knows the game right there.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't say they're like my favorite team to watch, but I do think, you know, a team that lost to St. Peter's in the Sweet 16 a couple of years ago when their road had really opened up. Then they got upset last year in the first round. Their redemption opportunity here is pretty fun. I think you can see that building with their players. They're finally getting close to it, and they're like, they're starting to feel themselves a little bit. They're ready for the "we told you so" moment, and that's going to be fun to see if they can get it.
And I'll be honest, I think you could throw Houston in the mix, but I mean, arguably, we have a chance for the top two teams in the country to meet for the state for the national title, and that doesn't happen very often anymore.
Yeah, and I think UConn and Purdue have clearly been the best two teams all season long. So I am looking forward to that matchup, assuming it happens. UConn's dynasty is obviously – I mean, this is incredibly dominant the way they've looked. If they can pull this thing off and finish off with another championship, that would be incredible to see. And then Bama's analytics too. Like Nate Oates, I talked to him years ago. I think it was like maybe 10 years ago when he had this kid named E.C. Matthews on his team that ended up going to Rhode Island. But Travis Steele – was recruiting him at the time as an assistant coach under Chris Mack. And I had talked to him at an AAU event, Nate Oates, and then I'd called him because he was a high school head coach, not an AAU coach, but he was there watching an AAU tournament. So I talked to him there, then talked to him another time on the phone. I was like, man, I really like this guy. It really seems like he's a sharp dude. And then to watch his ascension in college basketball has been incredible. I mean, he was really just that guy who was the high school coach, just like any of the guys that you coach with right now, Skinny. He was just the normal high school coach in the hallways at school. And then less than a decade later, he is now one of the top coaches in all of college basketball. And he does it with this analytical approach where he's like, we're going to just shoot threes because he understands basic math. And a lot of basketball people don't understand that. And they push back on shooting so many threes. But he understands that if you make a high enough percentage of all those three-pointers, 3 points are worth 50% more than two.
Yeah, and they literally won their Elite Eight game by just banging in a bunch of threes in the second half. I can't remember. There was a shot chart either last year or the year before at Alabama where the shot chart was all threes and all layups and dunks. That's all it was. No, it was nothing else other than that. Remember that game? The other game, I don't know who the opponent was, but I remember that shot chart.
I mean, that was one game where it was like literally nothing else, where it was so correct. Beautiful. But a lot of their shot charts are exactly like that because he is so committed to that analytical approach.
Yeah, they do, in my opinion, have maybe the best chance to beat UConn by just getting hot from three-point range. They also have a chance to get run out of the building by 20 like UConn's done to everybody else. I mean, that run against Illinois was the most ridiculous thing I've ever watched. That was so men and boys. I literally typed my boss, who was out at a hockey game, a Columbus Blue Jackets game, so he wasn't watching. And he was asking me for a score update. I said, well, UConn, it was close to the half. They're on a 24-0 run. By the time I got done sending that text, it had already gone to 30 at that point. I'm like, I've never seen anything like that.
My first year of calling NKU games, NKU went to UIC and had a 30-0 run in the second half of that game.
Yeah.
And at that time, I mean, I remember calling other friends in basketball and other coaches and stuff going, hey, just weird question for you. Have you ever seen a 30-0 run happen? Like, do you know if that exists? Like, because it was so absurd to watch in real time. Right. And then seeing this, that was a Horizon League game against a really bad UIC team that was kind of falling. They weren't terrible at that time, but they were kind of falling apart a little bit. To see that happen in an NCAA tournament game, with two of the best teams, I mean, that's wild to see happen like that.
I mean, honestly, that was a legit Illinois team. That was a legit Elite Eight game. That wasn't bracket falling apart game. That was a legit team that UConn just stomped.
With one of the most talented scorers in the country on their team who couldn't get anything for that whole stretch while they were going down 30-0 in a run. I mean, that's...
For the first three tournament games, Terrence Shannon. He'd been great.
Yeah, that's something... Like, UConn is doing some things that makes this dynasty fun to watch and worthwhile to talk about and all those things. I mean, they are really... I remember the Florida back-to-back.
They were good.
They were really good. I don't remember them being quite this dominant during that second run through, like blowing teams out the way UConn is.
No, I don't think they were doing that, but they were really, because they just had really every good part you would want. They had bigs, they had shooters, they had point guard, they had defenders, they had NBA talent. Those were two really good teams. That was Billy Donovan really started a nice run from like 99 through 2010-ish, and those two teams were part of that run. But, you know, I know there are a lot of people who dislike UConn because they dislike Danny Hurley and the way he reacts, and I get all of that. But I think he's a great coach. I think he was a great coach even before he did this stuff at UConn. This has cemented that. And that's just, they're just fun to watch because I just love the way they play on both ends of the floor.
I agree. Danny Hurley, and this is a question I wanted to ask you too. Danny Hurley is so good as a coach. He's clearly put himself in that elite tier echelon. I know last year was kind of his first year of deep NCAA tournament run success, but winning it all and now going back this year again, I think we can sort of bypass a level or two of the coaching tiers with him and put him right up there at the very, very top. But I was listening, I think it was actually Kentucky Sports Radio that might have been talking about this. Someone this week was having the conversation of like, have we seen a changing of the guard when it comes to the top coaches in college basketball? Being obviously, we've seen a few guys get out with Coach K and with Jay Wright recently in the last few years. And
Roy Williams not too long ago.
Roy Williams, another one. And then we've seen, you know, like a guy like Izzo, Michigan State has started to fade here a little bit. So that topic was being bantered about of who are kind of the new top coaches and has there been a change in the guard? And I'm like, okay, Hurley, definitely. He is clearly now in that group. Would you say there's been a changing of the guard, though, at the top?
I do, because I think Izzo, to me, has always been one of my two or three. If you'd ever asked me for years, Patino and him would always be in the 1-2 mix, and then I could float somebody else in there in and out of that top two or three tier. But clearly, to your point, Michigan State has started to fade, and it's arguable that it's maybe time for Tom to say enough's enough, and I hate to do that because I love him. When I covered Michigan State-Kentucky games, I don't like press conferences per se. I think they're not a waste of time. You're doing your job. But his were actually enjoyable because there was a give and take. There was banter. He tried to answer questions honestly, and I just respected him for that, but I also respected the way his teams always played. I think to your point. I think this was kind of a – I don't know if he's in the upper tier. I don't know where we stopped that tier at top five, top 10 or whatever. But Matt Painter's been a really good coach for a really long time. And I think this finally got him into that. Okay, he's proving it now.
Yeah, so like that's where I was at when I started trying to think about this a little bit. I was like, I don't know that it's so much a changing of the guard as the old guard is kind of left. The old guard is starting to vacate the premises. And we're kind of looking around going, okay, who's up next? I'll be honest, like, I don't think there's been a real change of the guard. I think Hurley and Oates are the two names that have kind of come up from the lower levels and kind of risen up to become elite coaches. But then after that, I think if we're talking about the top coaches in college basketball right now, it's going to include Bill Self is still obviously in that mix at Kansas, and he's been in that group for a long time. Yep. I would agree with you on Painter, but Painter to me is a guy that's kind of like been knocking at that door forever. He's such an experienced coach. I don't know that I put him as like a changing of the guard moment. It's kind of more that's like he's gotten over the hump a little bit. It's kind of one of the last men standing here. And then aside from that, it's like Scott Drew, Bruce Pearl. I mean, like maybe Rick Barnes is kind of like having a resurgence here because he's hung on long enough. I mean, think about the guys that were in the tournament late this year that we're talking about here. Kelvin Sampson is as good as it gets right now. But again, he's what, 70 years old. I mean,
right. Yeah. But I mean, even to your point with Rick Barnes and Mark Few for sure. I mean, the consistency of what they've done, I think puts him in that mix for sure. But I mean, to your point, I like a Bruce Pearl. I think Bruce is a really good coach, but really good coaches also don't lose to 13 CDL in the first round of NCAA tournament. I mean, you can do it every once in a while, I guess, but I just don't know if that puts you in there. And obviously Cal's star has faded so far. I don't even know what the hell tier you put him in anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I guess it's a weird conversation to have because I kind of agree with the idea that like, oh yeah, we've seen some of the top names leave, the real top names leave, and some of the other guys may be fading a little bit. It might be past their prime or the new way of the NIL and transfer portal doing business has kind of put them behind the eight ball a little bit all of a sudden. But I don't know that we've really seen a bunch of new names kind of rise up. And again, when we start talking about like who's going to take a Kentucky job if it opens, that's hard to figure out who that would be right now because I don't see a clear-cut answer.
If you went to their message board after the – when did Auburn play? They played on that Friday, right?
Yeah, I think Auburn's Friday. Yeah.
We watched the game. So I went to one of the Kentucky message boards after the loss to Oakland just to see the fan reaction, which I knew what it was going to be. And obviously then there's the list of, all right, if Cal's fired or doesn't come back, who are the names? And Bruce Pearl was like at the top of the list. I thought, I get it, but – then if you flame out, then what does the fan base do? I think that's where you're at with some of this stuff of, yeah, but has he really done? He's done it, but is he really? I mean, I think Nate Oates is in that category of really good coach, but until he made a Final Four, you couldn't bump him up a tier.
Well, and that Nate Oates is a guy like Hurley clearly is now elite in my opinion. But Nate Oates is a guy that like I would still have, like I love him. I think I'd probably have him in my group of top coaches. But if anyone else wants to argue, like, I don't know if he's done enough to be considered in that top group yet, I would probably agree with them. I'd be like, yeah, okay, that's probably fair. So I guess that was more of my thing is it hasn't been as much of like these new or younger coaches rising to the top as it has been like there's been a lot of guys who've hung around for a while. And since some of the top guys have either fallen off or gotten out, they've sort of had their moment here for a couple of years, it seems like. But I don't know that we've really seen a new guard come in, so to speak.
And I do wonder how much the portal changes all of that, right? How hard is it going to be the guy to stay on top for a life? I think Danny Hurley could do that at a UConn. I mean, you could argue maybe not going back 70 years, but certainly going back 30 years, three decades, UConn is a clear blue blood program. Clear. Yeah. They had a little blip in there, but they clearly are a blue blood program in that time.
Yeah. Well, I think this is this is going to be interesting to see how it plays out going forward for UConn and Danny Hurley too, because to your point, it's like you've had really good talent here to start these, you know, the last 2 years you've had really great talent and that's a big part of your job acquiring that talent. But did you kind of get lucky? Did you sneak a couple guys in that people didn't realize, or has he figured out the best way to handle this transfer portal NIL era? Because that's how it was for Cal. Like Cal figured out the one and done era first and he dominated that. Has Hurley figured out the new era first, or did he just have the right talent at the right time?
I'll be honest with you. I mean, the roster construction has been really good, right? You got two good athletic guards. And again, this is easier to me saying this than it was probably done. Two great athletic guards, a good size four, a 7 foot plus center who can do things on both ends of the floor, a slasher, a kid off the bench who jumps out of the gym, another guy who can shoot it. I mean, it feels like their roster is constructed perfectly.
Yeah, and they've had a nice blend. That's the one thing when you try to look at, okay, so how have they done it? I don't think there's a clear instructive answer to be like, well, they've clearly gone the portal route or they've clearly gone the develop your own talent route. It's like, well, they've had Donovan Klingon, who's a freak that they developed themselves. They recruited, they got him. They've got Stephen Castle, who's a freshman this year, is going to be a one and done guy who they recruited and got landed. That's just big time talents that anyone would succeed with. But then they've also gone and gotten a guy like Tristan Newton, who was a two-year transfer from ECU. He had played 3 years at ECU, had 2 years left to play at UConn. He's been great for 2 years for them. Cam Spencer might be as good of a transfer as there was in college basketball this past year. They got him from Rutgers. He had played at a mid-major a couple years before that, went to Rutgers for a year, now came to UConn, and he's been an absolute perfect one-year college basketball player. Not an NBA talent, but a perfect college basketball transfer. So it's not like there's been one way that they've put together this roster. It's been a nice blend. Well, and that's where I don't know exactly what you should take from that as another school trying to copy it.
Yeah, I mean, to the point I'm trying to make, I think you're making it a little bit too, is it feels like he's identifying what the talent is to fit that need. I mean, like, maybe on a less talented team than he had, Cam Spencer, he doesn't even go after because maybe he doesn't fit. On this team, he's a perfect fit. And so I think there's some of that, too, of identifying, you know, this isn't a superstar, but, boy, this is the perfect fit for us. We need this guy. He doesn't need to be a high-volume shooter, but he can do it when we need him to. He can make an open shot when we need him to, but he doesn't have to. He shares the ball. He'll defend. I think he's really good at doing that, of roster construction. And we talk about that with Cal sometimes of, great, you have 3 7-footers. What the hell are you going to do with him?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, and specifically with the Cam Spencer thing, because when I was going through UConn, I spent some time on this trying to figure out the other day of like, what are they doing? If I was another team, I'm looking at UConn's roster construction, how do I copy it? And like the Cam Spencer one is where you start going down the, well, see, he just understands fit. He's getting guys that really fit what he wants to do and high IQ, understand system. But then it's like, okay, but Donovan Kling and Stephen Castle, those are just big time talents that you got to be able to land too. And if you don't have guys like that, you're not the same team. So that's the other part of this, is you do have to kind of have the ability to recruit like a blue blood. And UConn has that ability. And NIL is changing all that, I understand. I'm just curious to see. I think Dan Hurley, from an X and O standpoint, is literally as good as it gets in college basketball. So I think he's fine there. I'm just curious to see what it looks like for UConn going forward. Because now they have all the cachet. They can keep recruiting at a really high level. Seems like he knows what he's doing in terms of putting this roster together. So can he keep this thing rolling for another handful of years? That would be incredible to see them go on a dynasty run like that, because we haven't really had that for it feels like, I mean, kind of Duke and UK did the thing during the one and done where they were taking turns going back and forth a little bit, and then since then it's been kind of open more so. Skinny, I wanted to ask you about some coaching changes too.
Sure. Yep.
That have taken place involving some local guys. Pat Kelsey was introduced as the new head coach at Louisville. We had talked a lot about that search as it was going on. And then right after that, Chris Mack was just introduced as the new coach at Charleston over the last few days. I'm almost speechless by that. I know we're a few days, we've all known this news, but it's mind-boggling to believe that this is where we're at.
Yeah, I didn't know you were bringing this topic up, because I was going to bring it back up to you if that was the case and asked you this, because the Vandy thing came and went. There were some reports that weren't credible, and none of us really ran with them, that, you know, he was going to be the next Vandy coach. It's a Power 5 school, maybe not a great program at the moment, in a tough spot in the SEC that's getting better with other teams coming into it, but it's still a Power 5 job. His daughter's playing volleyball there. It seemed to be a natural fit. That didn't come and go. And I think you and I privately discussed this. I think I even asked you this, and I don't want to talk out of school, so I'll just ask you the question. I said, do you think he takes a mid-major job? And you didn't think he would. I didn't either. And lo and behold, he does at Charleston.
Yeah, it's funny, because actually a couple people that I texted, Jed DeMusi being one of them, but a couple other, like Xavier guys that I'll text with constantly about this stuff, I mentioned when Pat took the Louisville job, I said, there's no way that Chris takes Charleston, right? And like, everyone's kind of like, man, that wouldn't make a lot of sense. Just don't know if he wants to go that route and go do the mid-major thing, or if he'd rather just not coach. But Charleston is a place where you can win at.
Yep.
It's been proven there. They've had success.
John Cressy won there. Pat won there. I mean,
it's already rolling because of Pat. He has them in a good spot right now. And let's face it, Charleston is a great place to live. It's a great place. And the spot they're in, they'd already moved from the Cincinnati area down to Florida for this last year, kind of in that general southern area. It feels like this is probably a move that makes a lot of sense. It's pretty easy for the family, right?
So, yeah. So, I mean, the other Power 5 jobs open, like a USC, is not a fit for him. There's a handful that probably won't. I mean, was this a matter, I wonder, if of him? I don't know if he needed to rebuild his reputation, Rick, but I think the further you're away from coaching, the less athletic directors think of you at a bigger school as a fit. Is this just a simple way to get back in for a couple of years, reboot the resume to some degree, show your coaching chops again, and then as openings continue to happen in the coming years, you go back to a major school? I think that would probably be the blueprint. I suggested that. You kind of shot me down, and I don't blame you, because I don't think you were wrong. And I don't think this is really as much – I don't want to call it reputation rebuilding because that's probably not fair. But, again, if you sit out another cycle in another year, then what do ADs think of you being 4 years removed from coaching? Do you think you're going to get a big-time job at that? Probably not. I think he probably realized that of, hey, this is a place I can go win. But to your point, great place to live. It's beautiful. I've got a name on the recruiting trail. I can get guys to come here and then have a good two-year run. Maybe one of those 2 years, go to the NCAA tournament. Hell, if you go 2 years, somebody's automatically going to hire you at that point. And so in retrospect, it probably does make sense.
One thing that I've seen from coaches who have had this situation where you build up, you go to the high major route, you get kind of your dream job or that big time payday job, and then it flames out and you go away for a couple of years and you make the comeback. When they come back that next time, they have a different level of perspective and they are much more level-headed, calm. And I think one thing for Chris is what you said is probably right. He's probably going to be there for a couple of years and then go on to another big job. But I also think you get that sense of I made my money. My family's fine. We're not worried. This isn't about a payday right now. This is about finding the best life going forward for me and my family and really enjoying coaching basketball. If things work out really well at Charleston and he really has that thing rolling, I don't think it's impossible to think Chris Mack might be the type of guy that could end up at a school for, you know, a decent period, kind of ride out the rest of his coaching career at one place that maybe isn't at the highest level that he does really well at, that's an enjoyable place to live. That wouldn't be the most shocking thing to me, but I think most likely the scenario you brought up is the real one, which is he's going to be there for a couple of years, kind of rebuild the resume, become a hot name again. And he will, because he is a damn good basketball coach.
Oh, absolutely.
He'll do well. I mean, think about this right now. Charleston went from a coach who's never won an NCAA tournament game and has like one or two quad one wins on his entire resume to a coach who has four Sweet 16s, an Elite Eight, and a one seed.
Yes, correct.
That's insane to think about at Charleston. There's not a lot of coaches in the country right now that have four Sweet 16s to their name and an Elite Eight and certainly not a one seed. They've got that at Charleston.
And took Louisville to the number one ranking in the country at one point.
Yeah. And by the way, go back right now. Just do it real quick, because everyone likes to think like, oh, yeah, it got real bad there at Louisville for Chris at the end. Go back and go look at what happened those last two seasons. To think that they ran a guy out over the record that he had in those last two seasons compared to what they just went through the last 2 years. It's insane. I mean, it wasn't even that bad of a spot. Like, I know there were some few things behind the scenes that had gotten weird with all the Dito stuff and the Eric Wood video that came out. There are some things that weren't going great for him there. But overall, in terms of the overall basketball, the success, it wasn't a disaster at all. So I really don't think there's a big reputation cleanup or that he needs to prove himself in a big way. But I think that is what's kind of happening here.
Yeah, I go back to that. That's why I said I don't know if it's a reputation. I just think, again, if you sit out for another cycle, at what point do ADs simply go, no? I mean, you need to get back in and at least show your coaching chops a little bit. And maybe for him, too, it's a chance to go back and coach in a winnable situation. And then if that next offer comes knocking, go ahead and take it for the reasons of maybe not the money. The money's always a big part of it, but a chance to then go build something and build maybe a national championship team at some other place. Because I think it will happen, because to your point, he is a really good basketball coach. And again, I don't think this is the worst thing. I think initially, to your point, it was a bit of a shocker because it felt like, really? But then if you start to cut through it all of what major jobs are open at the moment and what would be fits for him at the moment, there just really aren't any at the moment.
Yeah, I think a lot of people felt that St. Louis job might be one that would be perfect.
But I think that's the Indiana State guys to have as soon as their season's over. And unfortunately for St. Louis at the moment, his season isn't over.
Yeah, that seems to be the plan there. And Josh Schertz is a great get for them. I think that's a really good hire. But that was the type of job where I think people were saying, okay, it's not high major, but they're trying to treat it like high major. They've got good NIL funding. They're a legit chance to win, that maybe he would take a job like that. I think Charleston is maybe not quite that same level as St. Louis, but it's a similar concept of a school that understands success, that is hungry for success, that wants to do well. Like, you could go to Vandy and that might be it. You might coach there for 3-4 years, flame out, and that's the end of your career now at that point. Or you just really go to a low level place after that. You go to Charleston, you're probably going to have some level of success. That means your career can continue kind of as long as you want it to after that.
Agreed.
Real quick, Pat Kelsey, Skinny, what do you think of Pat Kelsey to Louisville? This is such a let me say this, because we've talked about it a few times and I keep bringing up. We talked about it with football with Mark Stoops. I think coaches or athletic directors and universities are going to start making more inexpensive hires and flushing those coaches with NIL money. And I now think Pat Kelsey is the second time we've seen that in this coaching carousel. The first was Ohio State keeping their interim coach with Jake Diebler, just saying, let's not pay a bunch of money for a buyout. Let's give him whatever we have to pay him and give him as much NIL money as possible from our donors and see how he does. And I think that's kind of what's happened here with Pat Kelsey at Louisville.
From an X and O standpoint and motivational standpoint, Rick, most guys who coach can do it. You can plug them in at a lot of places and do it.
Exactly.
I mean, honestly, I hate to say it that way.
It's true.
Because, I mean, like I told you, I think I'm a really good coach. And so I don't know where I could wind up if I got plugged into someplace, how I would do. I just know that there's not a lot of difference between these guys. Now, there is as far as roster building goes, and as far as being able to recruit, and those that do it clearly are exceptional at doing that. But just from the pure day-in, day-out grind, everybody's almost all the same. They really and truly are. You run some different stuff, et cetera, and some guys are a little bit better at X's and O's and some in-game adjustments. But I think dime a dozen is not the right word. But to your point, I don't think you need the name anymore. And Pat's got a nice resume. And the thing is, he did it at two places. And so that to me shows he can coach. Plug him in, he can coach. Now you're plugging him into a better situation. Now he does have to be able to recruit at that high level. He's kind of done it to a degree at Xavier, but he's not the earmark of that program. It was Chris. But he's proven from just an X and O standpoint, he can go win games. And so to your point, do I need a $7 million guy that can do that when I can use the NIL money, no matter who the guy is? And this guy's just as good a coach or what? I think that's the route we're going to start seeing, to your point.
Well, and the big key there with, it's not just that we have to pay the guy $7 million, it's that we have to go get someone who has a $15 million buyout,
right?
Then we've got to pay him $7 million, and then we have a huge buyout for that guy if he's not the guy in 2 or 3 years. And in the new transfer portal NIL era, you're going to be turning over coaches quicker because you're having to ask for so much NIL money from your donors.
Yep.
So they're not going to just continue to give you NIL money for a coach that's not getting it done, so you're going to have to turn it over quicker. So I think the thing is now, quit worrying about the giant buyouts. Go get a coach that's younger, an up-and-comer, or an assistant that's already in your situation that you can just promote, and then give them as much NIL money as possible. And then if 2 or 3 years it doesn't work out, move on to the next cheap guy. Because eventually exactly. You'll hit on the up-and-comer that knows how Correct. To do it and can put your roster together. Probably.
Correct. And I think that's exactly the point of it, for sure.
Yeah. Now, I do think Pat Kelsey has a legitimate chance to succeed at Louisville. I don't think this is like a that they're going bargain basement higher here because they're not spending as much money. I do think he's a legitimate coach that is going to fire up this fan base. And he is as opposite of Kenny Payne as you could possibly find from a basketball coach's standpoint. So from that part alone, they did the right thing by hiring Pat Kelsey. He is going to win every press conference, every donor meeting, every recruiting visit, all of that stuff that he has for the next 6-7 months until the season starts. The fans are going to love him there. The only question now becomes, can he actually win? Can he get the right type of talent to Louisville? And that just remains to be seen, because we know how it goes with these fan bases. Like, they'll love him up until he loses that first UK game. And then
he's won two games and then gets blown out by Kentucky. And then the conference is 5-13. But and listen, I think anybody knows it. Listen, the portal area, you can get it done quickly. I don't know if you can get it done in 1 year, quickly, but you can get it done quickly. I think your charge is to get it done quickly. The interesting part to me, and again, I'm happy for Pat. I've said this when we were talking about this on the radio when I filled in for Mo. I've known Pat since I was covering high school sports at the Post back in the early 1990s, and he was Elder's point guard on a state championship team and kind of followed his career. So I root for guys like that. I'm happy Cincinnati. I'm happy for all of that. But it is strange, and I'd still love to know the behind the scenes of why Dusty May said thanks but no thanks, and why Josh Shirt said thanks but no thanks.
Yeah, well, that whole Louisville hiring situation was a mess, it seemed like. It was reminiscent of that UCLA hiring when they ended up with Mick, wasn't it?
Right, right.
They missed on several guys and kind of like, oh, you're our guy now.
Yeah, well, Mick had at least done a little bit more. I mean, Dusty May got to a Final Four, but for the most part, his resume isn't exactly, lengthy. Mick had pretty good success for a long period of time.
No, I agree, but UCLA went through like 10 coaches before they got to Mick, if you remember.
Yeah, the Dusty May one, him turning them down for Michigan and Michigan money, okay, I can give you that one. But Josh Shirts, and maybe he just says, I'm a man of my word. I've already given my word to St. Louis, and that's that, and I don't want to, renege on that commitment. Maybe that was the case for him.
But I find that hard to believe.
I do, too. So, again, Dusty May saying no, and I'm going to Michigan, I'll give you that. I can see that. That's a little tit for tat. Louisville's probably has more lineage in basketball, but probably financially it's the same, and I think – it's been proven you can win at Michigan. Several coaches have done it. It's not just a coach here and there. Several coaches have won at Michigan and won big at Michigan. Hell, Johnny Orr back in the 70s, into Bill Frieder, into what the hell's the guy? Steve, what's his face? I'm drawing a complete blank. The guy who coached the Fab Five. Steve Fisher.
There we go. Yeah.
Into Steve Fisher. I mean, even Juwan won, you know, at a point there. John Beilein won at there. So, I mean, you've had coaches, so you can win there. I get you that one. But to say no to Louisville because you're going to St. Louis makes me go, what?
Yeah, it's you just want to know, is it really just like the basketball rebuild that we all understand, or is there more behind the scenes that right. we don't get that has turned that place into a disaster? Because at one point, and when I say one point, we're talking like literally 5 years ago, Louisville would have been talked about as one of the top 3 to 5 jobs in the country.
Easily.
Yeah. All right, real quick, Skinny, we'll go through some of the local teams. The transfer portal is churning. It's been the talk of local college basketball fans. So let's just give a quick update. I'll kind of read where teams are at right now, what's happened in the transfer portal. You can kind of give your thoughts. We'll talk about them briefly. We'll start with the Cincinnati Bearcats. So far, all we know is Victor Locken has entered the portal, and Jizzle James has announced that he will be back, which is massive news for the Bearcats.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest part of that. Listen, this was probably a time for Victor to break away. The way things ended, the way the fan base reacted to him, I know you could say, hey, he could reinvent himself as back to being a five, and let's make him the main. No, this was the right thing for him to do, and probably the right thing for UC. You know, I think he proved in the Big 12 he just wasn't a great fit, and I, you know, it'd be interesting to see where he lands, because I don't think in a major conference, I think the same thing's going to happen to him. I think he's going to get pushed around, and he's just not going to be a stretch four. And I think this was the best thing for all parties, and certainly the Jizzle James news is huge for them. They needed him back. I mean, him. You made the point last week. Him, Skillings, Lukosius. That's a nice place to start to build your roster for next season.
Yeah, and. Getting him back was everything, and not just because of what it means for your roster next season, but what it means for Wes Miller, his vision, and how he's building this stuff. If you're going to say, like, we can recruit guys like Jizzle James, well, you can't have him for 1 year and then see him leave after Correct. He actually looked like he's going to be a player. So keeping a guy like him around and building your program around a true talent like him is huge for Wes Miller and his vision here. And I, you know, and it's not just like, it wasn't like a kind of maybe I'll be back thing. It's like Edgar and James is posting pictures on Instagram with Chad Dollar down in Miami. So yeah. I think you're in a pretty good situation right now if you're a UC fan and can feel good about Edgar and James. Jizzle James. The Victor Locken thing, Skinny, I just think it's funny that now it feels so obvious for these UC people that he was leaving and he wasn't a fit, yet midway through the season when we were talking about why is he still playing, why are there two big men in there, we were getting ridiculed by UC media people, or at least one of them, and Wes Miller, who are acting like people are crazy for thinking you shouldn't be playing Victor Locken or shouldn't be starting two bigs together. And lo and behold, the last half of the year, he couldn't get off the bench, and now he's leaving and couldn't possibly play for a Big 12 program. I think that's a little interesting.
Yeah, like I said, I just don't know where he goes, because I don't know what Power 5 league or power. I mean, the Big East isn't a Power 5 league because of football, but you know what I'm talking about. What power league, if you will, can he honestly play against front lines?
Yeah, no, it's just funny because we always see, you know, and I agree for the most part, like coaches see these guys every day in practice. They know who has the best chance to succeed and all of that. But that Victor Lockett thing, we were sitting there all year being like, this makes absolutely no sense. And finally, they got on that same page eventually.
Yeah, and it didn't help again that your two fives, literally one could play on one end, one could play on the other, and they couldn't play on the – and so you were literally a mess at two spots for a chunk of that.
That's what I'm most interested to see for Cincinnati is what do they do at that center position? Yeah. With Azeez and Jameel. Do those two guys leave? Do one of them leave? Do you bring in, you know, how much front court help do you bring in?
You have to bring in a more complete player. You have to.
You would think.
And then whichever the other one stays, there's my defensive guy if Azeez is the one that stays, or there's my, you know, 2 minutes to the next media timeout offensive threat that I can put in. That Jameel Reynolds gets me 10 minutes, 12 minutes a game, and so be I. You have to bring in a better five. And that's easier, way easier said than done.
Yep. All right, Xavier, Davion McKnight is coming back. He's the only player that has said publicly that he will be back next season. Obviously, they're expecting a few others to return as well. But they've had 7 players enter the transfer portal. Lazar Djokovic, Abu Usman, Gidas Namiksha, Sasha Shani, Kashi Enze, Cam Kraft, and Reed Ducharme are all in the transfer portal. They've also landed a transfer. Furman's Marcus Foster, a 6'4", 200-pound wing, shooter, rebounder, long, really long wingspan, has been added to the mix at Xavier.
Yeah, the guys that left, were you high on Enzi? Which one? You were high on one of those guys. I can't remember which.
Lazar Djokovic and Kachi Enze, I felt both had a lot of potential for different reasons. Djokovic, very skilled, a lot of potential on the offensive end. Enzi was more just like, had what Xavier lacked last year, which was toughness, athleticism, and rebounding. He was just raw in terms of his basketball IQ.
Yeah, but I mean, none of those guys moved the needle. I think McKnight coming back, adding Foster, assuming Desmond comes back, I think that's a pretty safe assumption. Again, much like the UC situation, if that's the case, it's a pretty good place to start. You know, you got the Powell kid coming from Centerville, I think can give you something right away. It's not going to probably be 10 points per game right away, but I think can give you something. Swain, another year of development for him. You know, the potential of Jerome Hunter and Fremantle back into the mix. Again, that's a pretty good place to start. And then add another shooter, add another slasher, probably add another big. You got yourself maybe a pretty good roster ready to go win some games next year.
Yeah, I would feel really good about Zach Fremantle, Desmond Claude, and Davion McKnight, and even Dalen Swain, if I'm definitely sure Zach Fremantle is going to be Zach right. Fremantle again. And if I'm definitely sure Desmond Claude is going to be back, which...
Well, you cocked your head when I said that.
There are a lot of rumors out there, man, and I don't think anything is done yet. I think if he was going to enter the transfer portal, you would think he'd already be in there. But he's from that Connecticut area, and there's one big program that is still playing the NCAA tournament that he might be waiting on. And there have been rumors out there for so long that I just – in the transfer portal era, Skinny, I don't think anything – when a guy hasn't said it publicly, I don't think anything is – set in stone, because it only takes one conversation of, hey, we can offer you more, to get a guy to change his mind and jump into the portal. And it's not like they need a long time to make a decision. It can be one conversation of, we can give you this if you jump in the portal today, then you're in the portal and you can commit them next day. I mean, it's not a thing that you need a lot of time to make happen. So I would still be worried if I was a Xavier fan about getting this roster to back. And then in terms of all the guys that are leaving, I wouldn't be really worried about any of them leaving. None of them were difference makers. None of them looked like they were going to be impact players necessarily next year. The problem is you have to have a roster for next year, and I don't know that you can bank on getting better players at all these positions through the transfer portal. So I would be concerned if I was a Xavier fan about what next year's roster is going to look like and how it all comes together. Just saying we have the transfer portal in the next 3 weeks to make it happen doesn't give me a lot of faith necessarily. I need to see those results.
I know he's not a great shooter, but what about backup scoring guard Marquez Warwick?
He's a guy that they have looked at. I think the problem with the fit there is Sean Miller's big project for this year, the big theme of this whole transfer portal is get bigger, tougher, better rebounder, more defensive minded.
And they got that with Foster. I mean, that dude averaged 7.5 rebounds a game. And I know he's at 6'4 in that league. You're capable of doing those things, but it does show he's got a willingness to rebound and he looks like a man.
Yeah. They went out and like, they need shooting. They got a guy who shot 36% as a sophomore and a junior, only shot 29% from three last year in Foster, but he has the things you're talking about, the wingspan, the rebounding, and so defense is a little inconsistent, but the rebounding and the toughness and strength and size is definitely there. With Marquez, he's like 6'1", 6'2-ish, not a defender, not a rebounder. I just don't know if he fits what they're looking for. I think they have a couple other guys. Dante Maddox from Toledo is really kind of one of the guys that they're in there after right now.
Well, I know you're going through each team, and I'll fast forward to Kentucky with Adu Thierro being in the portal, because that would seem to be a potential fit for Xavier, right? I mean, he considered them. He was a different player then. He was a 6'3 guard who's grown into a 6'8 wing. Again, not a great scorer, but a terrific defender. And I think he's a potential low double digit scorer if he gets the minutes necessary for that. It would be interesting, though. I mean, does Kentucky, from an NIL perspective, look at a guy like him and go, because he actually left the door open in his letter saying, I'm entering the portal, that he would consider coming back to Kentucky. If it got to an NIL bidding war, I don't think Xavier would have to bid all that much to outbid a Kentucky for a guy like that, right?
It's tough to say when you're talking about NIL dollars and how much it would cost them. I really don't have a good answer for that. But to your point about would he be a fit for Xavier, absolutely. They've already reached out to him. Now, I think there are a lot of other teams that are interested in Adu as well. They did recruit him the first time around. There is a little bit of a connection there. I think that's going to be a tough one for them to reel in. But to your point, he'd be the best defender on your team. He'd give you tons of versatility. So you've kind of got an insurance policy for if Zach and Jerome aren't back at that forward spot, you can easily slide Du in at the four and be like, we've got that covered. But he can also play the three if you need him to, slide between multiple spots, help with your rebounding. He'd be perfect for what they're looking for. I think that one's going to be a bit tough to pull him out. And on that same note there with Kentucky, Skinny, that's the only name that we've heard in the portal so far is Thiero, and they have not added anybody else yet either. But we did see recently, either yesterday or the day before, some news came out that it does not sound like John Calipari is going to make any staff changes, which is a little bit surprising.
So what was this meeting with Mitch Barnard about? Did they just kiss and hug and go, hey, listen, man, I'm going to ride you out, and if things go bad, I'm going to retire anyway. So let's I don't need to make a change now. You're my guy. I'm retiring next year. I'm 65. I'm talking like Mitch Barnhart. So I'm just going to ride this out, and the new AD can make his own damn hire. I'm not going to fool with it. That's honestly what this feels like.
After the meeting last week, Matt Jones had reported the next day that he's expecting 2 to 3 new assistant coaches. And then all of a sudden this week, everyone's changed their tune. Even Matt Jones said, yeah, I now think that it's a chance there are no changes made to the staff at all. And I'm with you, Skinny. I'm sitting there thinking like, okay, so what was the last week about? Essentially, everyone just came to the conclusion of, you know what? No one's going to stand up to Cal. That's fine. Just run it back. Do whatever you want. I mean, because that's kind of what it feels like. And if I'm a UK fan right now, I feel terrible about that.
And I'll be honest with you. I mean, now Mitch Barnhart seems like he made a home run hire in the women's coaching circles. They hired a guy from Virginia Tech that's done a great job building that program up. But I honestly wonder if he just didn't want to fool with the coaching search. And if honestly he is thinking, he may not. He may be the AD until he's 75 for all I know. But he does turn 65, I believe, next year. It's a retirement age. I'm sure he's got plenty of money socked away from being an athletic director. Did he just say, you know what? I only got a year left to do this. That's all I want to do anyway. And why the hell do I want to go through a whole coaching search? I'll let the new AD do it.
Yeah, he already had to do the women's coaching search, right? Like,
That was clearly out of necessity. I mean, Kyrie Elzy had to go. I mean, that was clearly out of necessity.
Yeah, but he's like, oh, I've already got one to do this year. I'm leaving next year anyway. I'm just going to get this women's thing done, and then someone else can handle the men's thing next year.
I mean, listen.
That'd be funny, but that's true.
I know the Kentucky fans who have said I've given up, not me personally, that they've given up on the program and they're not going to come back till Cal's gone. And you know me where I've been with Cal since literally day one. I just don't like him, and it's gone way more haywire than I thought it was going to go. But at this point, absence is going to make the heart grow fonder for fans who said, I'm not going to watch a game. Yeah, you will. You'll watch. But the pressure on this next year, my Lord almighty, with that – The first time they fall behind 10-4 in a game, and you've been in Rupp Arena plenty. I've been in Rupp and Memorial Coliseum as a fan, as a media member, and even good Kentucky teams that fall down 10-4, you feel this murmur. And also, you can literally feel tension in the arena. The tension will be 70-fold. That thing will blow apart.
We're already past that. The tension's already there. The murmurs started last year. I mean, we're past that point. You're right. The first time it happens this year, it's going to be full-blown boos in Rupp Arena. And I can't really remember. I guess maybe the Billy Gillespie era is the only time that I can really recall during my conscious lifetime that Kentucky fans have fully turned on the coach. Like even at the end of the Tubby thing, it wasn't fully there yet. There were still a lot of people that supported him and it wasn't totally negative. I think this year, like if this thing goes bad at all this year, it's going to be so negative from the fan base's perspective. Yeah. I don't know that we've ever seen anything like it from the UK fan base, at least since I've been alive.
And I'll be honest, he is an utter, utter coward. I mean, the fact that he still won't go, you know, they needed to have a press conference off of this. Not two dudes sitting on a TV set circle jerking each other, which is what they did for 30 minutes. This literally needed to be a full-blown press conference where hard questions were going to be asked and answers needed to be given. And instead, you leave your fan base hanging. And I get it. Listen, Kentucky fans, I know what the perception of them is. This time around, they're going to be right in their reaction to all of this.
I agree with you. It's the first year that I've always thought, like, Kentucky fans are crazy. Kentucky fans are crazy. They're so lucky to have Cal. Who else are they going to get? This is the first year where I've kind of flipped them. Okay, I think it's ran its course. I think the UK fans are right. I get where they're coming from. And every other blood program over the last few years has made a Final Four, Skinny. UK's the only one that hasn't over the last few years. So it's no longer just a, like, you guys are crazy. It's hard to do this thing. It's like, no, if you're really a blue blood program, which UK definitely is, you should have been back by now.
And you've had the seed line and or the bracket you've been in fall apart. Do you know that this game on the North Carolina State would have been Kentucky's opponent in the Sweet 16, I believe it would have been? I mean, there you go. I mean, The bracket fell apart for you again. The bracket fell apart the year you lost to Kansas State. And I know PJ Washington missed a billion free throws and you can't shoot free throws for them. I do get that. But the bracket fell apart and you still couldn't do it.
Yep. All right, NKU skinny. Marquez Warrick has entered the portal, but Trey Robinson announced that he is coming back for a fifth season.
We talked about that a little bit. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit. That's a nice comeback. You get it. And again, I don't know what Sam Vincent's going to be like from a health perspective, but he's back to the roster too. That's two good keep arounds.
Well, let's think about this. Just from the end of last year, LJ Wells was really coming on as a starter at the forward spot. He's expected to be back in theory. I think there may be a few other guys that may leave, but all the other guys, it sounds like, are coming back for the most part. I think Trey will be the only public announcement, but LJ Wells, Keena Tijere at the center spot, healthy. Sam Vincent, like you said, then you got Trey Robinson and Randall Pettis coming back too. Like, look around the Horizon League right now. Pretty much anyone that was on the first or second team is in the transfer portal from the end of the year. So all the stars are leaving for the most part, and NKU is bringing back a pretty strong core. And yes, you lost Marquez Warrick, the school's all-time leading scorer. I understand that's a huge, huge loss. But I mean, looking at this core, they could be in a pretty darn good spot next year.
Rick, you follow way more than I do. I have cursory knowledge of the portal. The kid from Milwaukee who entered it was like
BJ Freeman.
Yeah. Isn't his name associated with Kentucky?
Yeah, Kentucky is after him. In fact, a lot of people think that might be where he ends up.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. To your point, that's a pretty big loss for a team in the league.
Every team in the league has at least one of their top players, if not multiple top players, entering the port. But this is just the way the sport works, right? Now, if you show out, then you go capitalize on it and get paid six figures to go to the high major level. I mean, even Trey Townsend at Oakland has put his name in the portal today, and he's looking to capitalize on the run that Oakland made. So that's just the way of the world. But back to NKU, I mean, I think they've really, when you look at a lot of the mid-major teams and how much they have to rebuild their roster from year to year, if you bring back four, five-ish starter-like players, we didn't even mention Jeremiah Israel, who played a lot of minutes as a freshman.
Developmental guy there.
I mean, you've got like seven or eight guys that we're talking about right now that are all, Hubie Pavorius was injured all of last year. He's a shooter that you add back into the mix that's experienced.
Add a Victor Locken.
Nothing's out of the realm of possibility right now. I do think the one thing they have to do is the same thing they've done each of the last 2 years. And it's not easy, but they've done a good job of it. They have to go find a point guard that's plug and play, fill in, start at the one right away. Now, maybe Sam Vincent becomes your point guard, or maybe Randall Pettis slides to the point guard next year. But ideally, I think you have to go find a plug and play point guard that can start just like Michael did last year, and just like Xavier did the year before that. So I think that's going to be the real challenge. And I think the Division II transfer ups have worked out well for them. I'd say just go down, find the best Division II point guard you can, and see if it works out again for you three years in a row.
For sure.
All right, Skinny, we have been going for a long time. We have some Bengals topics here to get to. None of them are really pressing or time sensitive. Should we just pass these on to next week, maybe?
Pass those on to next week. That's fine.
Okay. All right, we'll wrap it up with a few.
We'll have literally one college basketball game and a little portal to talk about next week.
Exactly. So we'll get back into the Bengals talk next week. None of this stuff is too important here, but we do have some things to get to that we'll get your opinion on. But Ask Skinny Anything for this week. We'll wrap it up here. Will Zach Taylor win a Super Bowl in Cincinnati, Skinny?
I'm going to flip a coin on that. And it's not really aimed at him. It's just how damn hard the AFC is at the moment. And at what point then where you're battling Kansas City and Baltimore and Buffalo, although Buffalo had to lose a lot of guys to free agency, but you still got Josh Allen and other teams are getting better, how hard that road becomes as time goes on. And yeah, the window's still there for Joe Burrow, and yeah, it's still a really good roster. But boy, I'm going to say yes. I do say yes.
Over under 10 more years for Zach Taylor in Cincinnati.
If he wins a Super Bowl, I'd go over 10 years. If he wins a Super Bowl in that span, easily.
He'll be here for as long as he wants.
For a dude who at that point in his career, if he'd done nothing else, would have won a Super Bowl, gone to a Super Bowl, and gone to another AFC championship game in a 12-year window, pretty damn good.
Oh, no doubt. But if you're guessing, would you say he'll be here for another? You're saying he will win a Super Bowl, so I guess you would think he would be here for 10 more years.
Yeah.
All right. Who is your favorite NFL player that's not a current or former Cincinnati Bengal?
My favorite. This is going to be old school. Go look him up. Brian Sipe of the Cleveland Browns, the Cardiac Kids, the Cardiac Browns. Brian Seiple had so many comebacks, and he was just a gunslinger from back in the early 80s. I don't know why I like Brian Seiple, but I like me some Brian Seiple.
He looks like everyone's dad. Number 17 for the Browns.
And
shoulder pads are hilarious too.
They are. It is fun to watch.
The hip pads coming out of the pants, and then the giant shoulder pads are hilarious to look at.
I also like me some Dan Fouts with him wobbling back to pass and throwing flutter balls and somehow still being a Hall of Famer.
All right. Taking resources out of the equation, who do you think is a better basketball coach, Pat Kelsey or Wes Miller?
I'm going to go Pat because he's done it at multiple places. I mean, Wes had some good success where he was. And again, in a one-bid league, it's hard to define a guy going to the NCAA tournament all the time. He went enough, I guess,
right,
at Greensboro. But I think, Pat, you've done it at a couple places. Like I said, I think that shows you can coach. And I think Wes can coach. I still question him putting together a roster.
What is more likely to happen again? A coach lasting 40 plus years at the same Division I program without ever leaving, a la Greg Campy at Oakland, or B, a coach lasting 15 plus years at Kentucky, a la Calipari. This is actually sent to us last week, but we didn't get to it.
That's a great question. I think Cal said it best, and I think he's right. The lifespan of a Kentucky coach is about 10 years, and he's lasted longer than that. And honestly, his lifespan kind of burned out after 10 years. If you'd have stopped him at the 10-year window, Cal would be thought of extraordinarily fondly. I still think fans will look back at the Cal era when time comes and go, that was still a pretty good era. It didn't end very well, but it was still a pretty good era. Tubby, I thought, honestly, Tubby was a home run hire, and I think Tubby's a great coach, and it ended poorly, and it was trending in that direction. But Tubby lasted in that 10-year window. Joby Hall even. And it felt like, because Joby Hall was kind of the coach when I was a young guy up through my college years, and it felt like he was there forever. Joby Hall took over in 73, 74, and got out in 1985. So he wasn't – so that span seems 15 years is probably too long.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's legitimate about the Kentucky job. It just eats you up, and you either lose your mind or everyone just gets – and annoyed with each other. They've rubbed each other the wrong way long enough. It's like, I just don't think there's too much pressure there.
Because, and I think Cal's a victim of this too. Cal had such instantaneous success, won the national title, went to multiple Final Fours, that you took it for granted that that's what was always going to happen. Tubby won a championship in his first year, and it was, well, he did it with Rick's players. Well, yeah, he still was the coach that won the national championship. He still deserves credit for that. And then the bar was championship or bust. Tubby never missed a tournament. Tubby went to multiple Sweet 16s. He went to multiple Elite 8s. He never got to another Final Four, but by all standard of measure of success, he had really good success at Kentucky. But at some point, you were a victim of that success, and at the end, it burned everybody up, burned everybody out. Time to move on. I mean, dude went to Minnesota, for goodness sakes.
No, I know. I mean,
on his own.
And Tubby's funny in that he's kind of like what you were talking about before, where people look back at Cal and think of it more fondly than they did right now. That's how Tubby was. I remember at the end of Tubby's tenure, it was like everyone was so ready for him to be gone. We got to move on. This guy isn't Kentucky material. But now if you ask UK fans about Tubby, they'll all tell you how great he was. Yeah, I mean, they all love Tubby now. But in the moment, everyone was ready to be done with him. It's just it's a unique job like that. What recourse should local meteorologists face after predicting Hurricane Katrina and instead we got weather worthy of a pool day? We got a storm yesterday, didn't we?
Dude, I was in my basement because there was literally the track of a tornado was coming to Burlington, Kentucky. It was on the track. I thought our meteorologists, I thought Caroline Cohen, and again, I know they're on my station and they're my teammates, but I do want to give them a shot. I thought Tara Blake in the morning and at noon prepared people for what might be coming, warned that if the sun came out, it might get a little bit worse. I'm watching the Weather Channel all day. They are the gold standard, right? They actually had somebody broadcasting all day live from Covington because they felt like this was going to be the epicenter. And we had multiple tornadoes. Thank goodness it wasn't worse. Thank goodness the tornado was tracking towards me wound up tracking a little bit south, and I think then it dissipated. I wouldn't consider yesterday a pool day. Again, I was in my basement in my safe place for about an hour because, again, I'm watching the track of this. I'm like, that track is coming right to Burlington. And if it does, I ain't messing around going, I'm going to sit upstairs until it comes. I'm going to go downstairs until it passes. I'm sorry. I don't think they should face consequences whatsoever.
I think yesterday was actually one they kind of got right. It was legitimate. I do think it's like a little weird that now we like cancel schools and do some of this stuff for storms. I don't ever remember that being a thing before.
Again, I go by the Weather Channel. When they have a Torcon index of 7 out of 10, that's extraordinarily rare. That's rare high area. And the last time that this happened, I can remember I was working at Villa Madonna Academy, and it was the 2012 tornadoes that hit. And I suggested to our principal that day, I said, listen, I just talked to Tim Hedrick, who was the late Tim Hedrick, who was a meteorologist. And he said, and I said, trust me, he is not an over the skis. It's going to be bad. He said, it's going to be bad. He goes, you can make book on it's going to be bad. Okay. And I said, and again, we're a school that doesn't have buses, so you have to tell parents. I said, I think we should probably think about getting the kids out early. And she pondered and said, okay, yeah, all right, let's do that. And we did. And everybody was probably home by the time the storms hit. You know, the story of the Piner Elementary school principal who they had kids on a bus until Tim Hedrick said, hey, there's a tornado coming towards Piner. They got the kids off the bus, got them back in the school. And they talked about that bus probably would have been on a curvy road in Kenton County with a large drop off. One big wind gust, you have 50 kids dead. So, I don't think you – listen, growing up in Tulsa, I grew to respect tornadoes, man. And I get – meteorologists are easy punching bags. Again, I thought to Caroline's credit, to Paul's credit, I thought they were matter of fact. I didn't think they were over dramatic. I thought they were very detailed. I thought they were very analytical. They literally were telling you, here's where it is. This maybe isn't a tornado, but a tornado is possible out of this. That's all I need to hear. If it's possible, I'm going to go down. There's a potential spin up. It could spin up at any time. Yeah, it could spin up right over my house for all I know. So again, I want to give them credit and give them credit where credit's due because I don't think they over-dramatized this. It maybe wasn't as bad as it could have potential because there was a potential of EF2, EF3 tornadoes out of this, which are obviously very devastating. I think everyone that would touch down, at least in Kentucky and Ohio, were all EF1s at the most. But still, it's not like they didn't occur and didn't happen. They happened all over the place in the tri-state.
Credit to you for not having the typical like old man take on this and actually pushing back and giving people the real of what's going on with meteorologists and weather and how important it can be. That was a very well thought out take. And second of all, this is a little known thing about you. You're a big weather guy. Like, so yesterday, were you hunkered down on the Weather Channel and like scoping this out or what?
I was.
I thought about that as I was watching the storm. I'm like, I bet Skinny's into this right now.
Oh, dude, I watched it all day. I watched our local station. I flipped it over after we were off the news to watch the national stuff. And again, I mean, this dude's camped out right on the river in Covington. And at one point he goes, this is not good that the sun's coming out. And again, this was an army. This is a national guy who knows his thing too. And again, they didn't listen. They did this 2 days ahead of time. They knew where these storms were coming and they decided to park a guy right there in what they thought the epicenter was going to be. So if you think that was dramatic on our local people's part, the Weather Channel parked a dude here for the reason of what they thought was going to happen.
I'm not sure if you can speak on this much because you still work there, you're an employee, but I used to miss working when Scott Dimmick was in there. He would like come in and like start fighting with everybody about always really mad about the tone and temperament that our meteorologists were taking in the city, and he would like just be screaming at everybody. It was always just chaos whenever
he was great, though. I like Scott.
You know, it was funny. Yesterday, I'm at my parents' house picking up my kid, and we had to hang out there a little bit because all this was going on as I was getting ready to drive. So I was like, all right, we'll stay. And my brother comes down, he's got his laptop pulled up and he's following weather coverage. I was like, What are you doing there on YouTube? And he's like, well, I really only like following one guy. I'm like, who is he? He's like, Scott Dimmick. Yeah. I know him. I know him well.
Yeah. No, Scott still does his own thing, which is pretty cool in my opinion. But like I said, I thought our guys, especially Caroline and Paul, and man, you know how that, Rick, you've seen the behind the scenes of that stuff. I mean, they're trying to work a computer while they're talking about the storms, tracking it out, looking at chats that the Weather Service is doing. And they're doing it. I thought both of them did it in such a calm, measured tone that it's like, we're going to be okay. They're just going to let us know where it's going to be, and you got to ride it out, and we'll ride it out, and we'll be okay by 8 o'clock.
Why do people get so mad about meteorologists and weather stuff? Like, people really get angry about it and really dislike weather people. I've never understood that.
So I wish we'd have done this today, and we didn't, because my friend Tom Gamble said he ran into you and said he was maybe going to start making a phone call to this podcast each week. This would have been a dramatic scene with him as part of this because he called me as he goes, they're gonna be wrong again, Chief. Predicting all this chaos, nothing's gonna happen. I said, how about you call me after it comes through? I never got the phone call for him to say, I told you so. I talked to him this morning and I almost did an I told you so to him. Like, I told you we were gonna get some severe. Well, it wasn't that bad, Chief. Not tornado didn't land in our neighborhood, did it?
He makes a good point there. You did not physically get hit by a tornado. You, Richard Skinner, did not get hit yesterday by a tornado. Right. So he did win.
And we live in the same neighborhood, so neither one of us got hit.
On that note, I will say I ran into Tom Gamble on opening day at Smoke Justice. And if people want to start submitting maybe some Two Angry Guys questions or any questions about you and Tom Gamble, he did agree that he would come on and do an Ask Any Anything segment with us one day. So we'll get that going here in the next couple of weeks, hopefully.
The next time this weather thing happens, just bring it up to him and he'll go on his tangent with it. Wasn't our station, because I ran on the riot act. Called all this panic. Nothing's going to happen. Then he calls me and goes, one of them says it's going to, see, Chief, it's dissipating. Such and such said it's dissipating. I go, well, such and such couldn't be any more wrong because of these reasons. Oh, look outside. I said, that's the problem. Look outside. It's sunny right now. That's not a good sign, my man. Well, he said it's dissipating. Like, well, good luck to that. If you want to take that forecast, go with it.
You two are the best. That's going to be a great episode. I cannot wait for that.
I cannot wait.
That's all we got.
All right, good deal. Rick, thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week. It's been the Skinny Podcast, the weekly phone-free edition. For Rick Roaring, I'm Richard Skinner. As always, it's presented by Blake the Attorney Mason.